The following is a recording of the Q&A discussion with Dr. Brian Arp and Dr. Robbie Arrell from the fourth evening of Leeds Love Month 2003, exploring the future of intimacy. As a content note, this discussion may mention consent violations and sexual assault. Leeds Love Month was organised by the Centre for Love, Sex and Relationships at the University of Leeds. We hope to improve relationships by studying intimacy. You can follow the Centre on social media for news of future events and publications. The talk series was generously funded by the Society for Applied Philosophy.
The thing that I missed on your talk was a bit of a more critical view towards therapy, because I agree with you on the medicalization and all its drawbacks, but therapy also has drawbacks, and I guess that. So it's language-centric, it's also very individualizing, or can be very individualizing, and can miss the structural phenomenon. So in a way, I think the medicalized usage of psychedelics is going to be better for some people, right? And so that's the only, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so what I tried to do is to suggest that some people are going to benefit from this enhanced therapy through the introduction of a drug, but partly what I think we should think about is whether we can achieve those kinds of effects without the medicalization, so without the pathologization, for example. So it might be that we say, here's therapy, which doesn't, if you go to therapy, you're not admitting to having a mental health issue. Maybe you just want to work through some things with a therapist, and it can be very helpful for some people. For some people, it's ineffective. But if you can find that for those for whom it's effective, or it can be made more effective, or for those for whom regular talk therapy doesn't work, the introduction of a drug under supervised conditions can make therapy be better than it is for a lot of people. That seems like that would be an advantage. So it's not going to be, it's all risks or all benefits. It's just figuring out where that balance is. And I accept your point as totally valid.
Okay, great. So first question is totally valid. Does anyone have a question for either of our
Did we have an
speakers?
Invalid question?
Yeah, an invalid question.
Invalid questions?
I did have a question about the situation in Oregon specifically, I suppose.
Yeah.
Is it still criminalized for people to just take it recreationally?
Yes.
That is, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so they're trying to create this intermediate space where there's some supervision, some structure, and the idea is that you can legally acquire the drugs. I think you have to be 21, and you maybe have to fill out some forms, maybe some liability forms or something like that. And then you have to consume the drug on the premises. So you have to be in this space. But if you were to acquire the drugs from a dealer and use them in your basement, that would have the same criminal penalties as currently apply. Also, by the way, these drugs are still federally prohibited in the United States at the national level. So there's this very weird legal acrobatics that are happening right now where it's not seen as being in the interest of the federal government to pursue these cases as criminal cases. And there's an attempted allowance for some of these states to do a little bit of the, you know, states as labs experimenting with local policy kind of a thing. But strictly speaking, there's a conflict.
Yes?
From the first presentation, I was lacking a bit some statements regarding what people actually said about the effects. Because you were saying that we should not create the reason for the usage of drugs, but there were no actual statements on whether actually people have or would potentially use it for enhancing their relationship.
I did include some quotes from the 1980s where people would say they felt more loving toward their partner, or they were better able to forgive grudges from the past and so forth. So those were meant to be some illustrative examples of the kinds of things that people would feel had come about because of the drug-enhanced therapy from those early years. But in terms of new data, as I suggested, there was just this very preliminary trial with six couples. And so we don't have a lot of contemporary data with kind of elaborated qualitative reports of what people's experiences are like. So we're mostly drawing on anecdotes from the 1980s. But what I'm trying to do is to alert people to the fact that now this kind of scientific wave of research is just setting off in terms of the couples counseling. There's a whole bunch of work on individual level responses and quite a lot of work to try to document the qualitative responses of participants in these trials, like for PTSD. But the couples aspect is just, we're just peeking around the corner to see what might lie ahead.
Is there any research done into couples using these drugs in a non-medicalized context that we could compare the medicalized trials with? Because I guess the interesting point of tension in your argument is whether those situations actually turn out to deliver greater benefits, right? It's in a non-medicalized setting, things are calmer, you're at home, you're listening to your favorite music. Is there anything kind of exploring those situations, or you just don't have any data?
I'm aware of some ongoing research that's sending out like mass surveys to the general public to just ask them under conditions of anonymity and so forth to report on their own, you know, experimental recreational use in a way where people are feel safe that they're not going to be implicated in a criminal prosecution or anything like that. As far as I know, that data is ongoing in the collection. So hopefully there'll be some papers spilling out over the next few years. But as of right now, that kind of data is also lacking.
Yeah. Because you might imagine a situation in which you ask people, like a couple, to come into a room and drink a bottle of Pinot Noir together, have some cheese and listen to a jazz album with someone sitting in the corner, like supervising and taking notes and things. And they might find that very unconducive. But if you surveyed people and said, you know, have you had a hard conversation over a glass of wine? It's like,
There's a whole other angle to this, which is philosophical and legal arguments for decriminalization. So this is happening in parallel to all the debates that I was talking about, and I have contributed to those debates. I led a consensus statement of some 60 colleagues, which says racial justice requires ending the war on drugs, because in the United States anyway, the pretense of drug safety is used to put disproportionately black and brown men behind bars and affects those families and communities really poorly. And so a whole different model from everything I've been talking about, not just the Oregon model of this kind of consuming it in a safe facility thing, or the medical model of a therapist administers the drugs in a clinic, is just decriminalize the drugs. And then if people want to use them on their own, that's up to them. And at the very least, they shouldn't face criminal penalties. And I, in fact, have made that argument. So, we need to consider the fact that a lot of these drugs have been used for the last 50 years entirely outside of any kind of medical model or enhancement model. And they will continue to be used in that way. And so we need to face that squarely and try to collect as much data as we can about what are the benefits and risks in these non-medical situations.
Hmm. Does anyone else have a question they'd like to ask or comment to make to either speaker?
When you said microdosing, you said quote-unquote microdosing. Why the quote-unquote? What's your position with regard to microdosing?
So the only evidence that I've seen about microdosing that's been reasonably robustly collected suggests that there's no effect beyond placebo for microdosing. So there doesn't seem to be any effect that's due to the chemical action of the drug at a sufficiently low dose. Whereas the therapeutic effects that have been observed in the trials led at Hopkins and so forth have all been pretty significant doses.
Thanks. I had a question for Robbie. You mentioned the Sexual Offences Act. I was wondering if you think that the law needs to be changed to kind of keep up with teledildonic technology, or if it's encompassed by what we have already.
I think that probably in certain jurisdictions, I mean, not many jurisdictions have the kinds of laws that cover those, especially the deception by, not the deception by misrepresentation case, right? That's where you lie about some characteristic about yourself, but you're still identical, qualitatively or you know, numerically identical to who you are. Not many jurisdictions have laws, I think, around the other type of case, which is the deception by impersonation. So I think the UK is in a good place in this. There's some states, I think, in America, Nebraska, maybe. There's like a few. Canada, I think, has something also built in. There was actually a case that was criminally tried in Israel a few years ago where a man was prosecuted for deceiving a woman about his religion and got lied to her about his religion in order to procure sex with her, and was found guilty.
Of sexual assault?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that it's practical or maybe even desirable to try to, you know, develop law that speaks specifically to this. But I think it's hopefully you would just like to, if you genuinely think, it's not just, my interest in this isn't just really the technological side of it, because, you know, it's easy to talk about that because there's interest in people like that, you know, and we did kind of say we're talking about the future of stuff. I'm interested at a level just without the technology, because I think it's a proper serious issue. And I think it's bad. Like, I've spoken to Rape Crisis Dublin and people about maybe the possibility of developing guidance on it, because there isn't anything out there, right? So if my intuition is correct, that maybe some people have experienced something like this, there's nowhere for them to go, right? There's no information out there, right? So
Can I ask you a question, Robbie? So I think you alluded to this a little bit, but somebody might recognize that they've been violated in some way by the use of one of these technologies. But I imagine that a perhaps even more common situation is going to be people who intuitively feel wronged, but they don't have the concepts available to articulate their experience. The classic case of this is when people were sexually harassed before the concept of sexual harassment existed in the culture. And so they just had this kind of icky feeling that they didn't know how to label until that concept was introduced. And it seems like in this case, because it's not a paradigmatic instance of sexual assault of the kind that we're used to thinking about or hearing about or seeing depicted, I worry that a lot of people are going to be in a situation where they feel that something wrong has happened, but they can't name it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, that's a great kind of way of thinking about it, you know, in line with sexual harassment. And at a time when people were like, you know, oh, it's just a bit of jolly around the office or whatever, and you might have felt uncomfortable about it as a woman particularly, but it wasn't a spoken about kind of a thing, right? And I kind of see, like, I should say Emily, my wife here, I always acknowledge Emily in everything that I publish, because Emily's not a philosopher, but Emily educates me in other ways that always informs my philosophy, and particularly on this particular topic, we watched, what was it, The Housewives of Atlanta?
Yeah.
Real Housewives of Atlanta?
Yeah.
You know, and so you got a real house, and what was the other, there was another movie with Katherine Heigl in it, The Ugly Truth. And there's scenes in both of those. So in the Housewives of Atlanta case, they're going out for a night, all of the housewives with their partners, and one of them insists that they all wear like these remote control panty vibrators, right? And when they're on the bus, it turns out, I mean, the security is so bad, the privacy security is so bad on some of these devices, that one of the husbands was like, it actually connected to a different woman's panty vibrator, right? To who it was. And, you know, this kind of sort of hilarity ensues or whatever, like. But, you know, you can imagine somebody feeling quite uncomfortable about that and maybe kind of feeling like, I feel somehow violated, but, you know, it's just what the same way people used to maybe feel about sexual harassment, like. And it, like the Katherine Heigl, the movie, that movie, that scene from The Ugly Truth, is where, was it her partner or something? Similar kind of thing, vibrating, like a concealed vibrator that she's wearing that can be remote controlled. The remote control falls out of her bag during dinner. This is like a work dinner. And a child at the next table picks up the remote control and starts playing with it. And she basically has an orgasm in the middle of the dinner. And this is like, again, hilarity ensues. And you're like, this is, I don't know if this is, you know, will we look back on that one day and kind of think, well, this wasn't so funny, right? Like, you know, but that's great. I'm going to use that, right? That analogy with sexual harassment.
So can I follow up on that, right? So the response to Natasha is a kind of educational one. We need to provide people with the concepts and resources to understand that this could be a harm and that we've got a name for it. But I may be wrong about this, but when you had the screenshot of the Sexual Offenders Act, it said, you talking about impersonation, it said it's an offense if somebody is impersonating someone known personally to the victim. And I'm wondering if that actually needs to be changed, right? So a lot of the cases that you were describing are adjacent to cases where maybe somebody's impersonating a celebrity or they're impersonating a program. And so you might think that restriction is way too narrow, right? If this technology is allowed, if people can remotely impersonate, you know, porn stars or celebrities or AI avatars, it kind of opens up this other realm of potential assault, which just isn't captured by the law as it stands. And it's kind of overly narrow restriction. Like, why is it any less assault if I don't know the person whom you're impersonating? So I just think, I mean, it's more of a comment than a question, but like that seems to be a case where the law might need to be changed. So maybe you should set about and change the law.
The impact.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But
I wonder, is that though more, that kind of case, is that not more the deception by misrepresentation case, right? Rather than, see, because they're very different. The distinction between these is quite important in a way, because most people don't really, it turns out, thanks to Brian, put me onto a study by Lauren Summers? No, who was it? Rosanna Summers.
Oh, Rosanna Summers, yeah.
About common sense conception. You know, most people, the folk notion of common sense conception, most people don't believe that deception invalidates consent in most cases of research has been carried out to, you know, but they don't believe it in cases where the deception involves a misrepresentation about who you are. So if you misrepresent yourself as a celebrity and you're not, most people are going to say, you know, even if the person says, I wouldn't have had sex with them, but for I thought they were, I don't know, a footballer that played for Man United, and they're not. Most people are going to say, even though you only slept with them as a result of the dissent or deception, that's not rape, right? Deceit, in most people, in the common sense, doesn't always vitiate or invalidate consent. But when surveyed about the impersonation cases, right, where the person that you believe yourself to be having sex with is the person that you are having sex with is somebody completely different to the person with whom you believe you're having sex with. Then most people will say, yeah, the deception in those kinds of cases vitiates consent. So I think it's, but you know, I'm all about changing the law if I can do that too. So
okay, we'll do that later. does anyone else have a question? So.
The very last one, just about the multiple perpetrator thing, really. It's more of a comment than a question, I suppose. I wonder if you kind of like overcomplicate, obviously that's a possibility, I wonder if you're kind of overcomplicating it to a point, because I'm chronically online and I read stories about people being assaulted by a twin brother or a father at night, you know, you can't really see it properly. Obviously, with those people being in close quarters together, it's much more likely for them to have access to the equipment to do the deception. Is that something that you've looked into, or...?
Again, to reference the paper I was talking about, that's one of the cases that is put to people. The twin case, right? Where it's kind of said, you know, you believe you're having, the person you're having sex with is, you know, this person, but actually it's their twin. That's a case of rape. Most people are on board with the case there. The deception is of a type that it does invalidate consent and it does qualify as rape by deception. But I think I absolutely can imagine that happening. I mean, the rarity I sort of alluding to with the multiple perpetrator rape by deception. And I don't, like, I can, maybe I'm just not looking, maybe I'm not just doing the right searches or something. You can imagine, I suppose I can imagine, you know, a case where, you know, somebody says they'll sleep with the twin brother, you know, the brother, one of the twins, But actually the twin kind of says to his brother, you know, why don't you take this one or whatever? So I'm sure that's not only, and that would qualify as a, by my definition, as a case of multiple perpetrator rape by deception.
Yeah. Or, I just more meant like, I don't know, like intuitively I feel like it would be more likely for someone for that to happen where the twin doesn't know about it.
Yeah.
Than the multiple perpetrators. I'm not saying that that wouldn't happen necessarily, but yeah.
Oh yeah, the single perpetrator deception is, yeah, there's lots of cases.
Without involving the hacker in there, basically.
So I think there's a question.
Yeah, finger point, because I wasn't sure about this. Sorry, how do you call the multiple perpetrator rape? How do you call it?
By deception.
Yeah. So in the case, you know, like the college student that you said, this is not what actually happened, but what if the boyfriend had been complicit and had said to his friend, you know, go upstairs, she sleep, and she's going to think it's me. You think that is gang rape?
Yes.
Really? Because
you mean by
he could be complicit, but is he actually raping?
Well, I mean, this is kind of, I know I flip-flopped in this presentation between talk of sexual assault and rape. If I'm writing about this, you know, in a philosophy paper, I'll stick to the sexual assault. I mean, in most definitions, in the UK, in the definition of the Sexual Offences Act, that's what you don't have to, as somebody who's collaborating in a sexual assault against an individual, it doesn't require that each person penetrates. It may require that if you want to try everybody on rape, right? But it doesn't require that for everybody, you know, to try somebody for sexual assault. It's sufficient that you're complicit, particularly if you're the person who's orchestrating it, right? And you don't even, yeah.
Okay, so we have 5 minutes, so time for some more questions. We have one at the front. Does anyone else want to ask a question as well? I just want to gauge the room. Okay, so have a think about that. We'll go to you at the front.
So it's a question for Brian. So it's really about the authenticity worries that you sort of touched on a bit. So I kind of get that if some chemical that you take causes you to not regard as awful or not experience as awful the awful behaviour of a partner, there's some kind of way in which that's not really your reaction, or if you've kind of got PTSD from the horrors of war, but you kind of get given a chemical that makes you come to regard the world as not especially dangerous, or the chemical makes you feel that, you know, general sort of love and benevolence perhaps about nothing in particular or about the world in general. There's kind of worry that isn't exactly yours, even if it's got beneficial effects. So, I mean, that sent me wondering about the ways. So that's, I kind of can see that there's a set of things to kind of think about in that area, but there's a neighbouring area, our engagement with fiction and fictional works of various kinds, where we think it's perfectly normal, indeed beneficial, to kind of enter into emotional states that in a way aren't really ours. They're we have them as consumers of the fiction, as readers of the novel, as viewers of the film, in which we're sort of able to try out a way of looking at the world and go through it. And those can actually cause beneficial and sometimes harmful changes to how we end up behaving towards those around us, because they just open up for us new outlooks on the world. I mean, what do you see as the sort of similarities and differences between the kind of altered states that psychedelic drugs enable and this more everyday thing that we seem very comfortable with, namely the role of the arts and fiction in our lives?
Yeah, I think that there can be transformative experiences or perspective-shifting experiences that are not drug-mediated. And it may be that there are some analogies here where, in either case, you want to figure out what of this experience should I take with me moving forward into my ordinary waking consciousness as being a genuine insight versus what is something that feels like an insight but is really misleading in some kind of a way. And so I wouldn't be inclined to draw some sort of hard distinction between the challenge one faces with respect to drawing that distinction through a drug-mediated altered state or through seeing a really amazing film or play or something like that. I wouldn't think that there's a difference in kind. It might be that the imaginative powers that are unleashed through certain types of psychedelics tend to be more dramatic than the ones that we might encounter through reading a really good novel. But I don't think there's a sharp distinction there, and I think it's good of you to think to compare them.
Yeah. Really, it's my pleasure to thank both of you. The talks were fantastic. We've got a lot to think about. And thank you all for being here. It's been great, and I really enjoyed this evening. So thank you very much. Thanks to our speakers.